Good morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Armando Pavaza, professor of psychiatry at the University of Missouri Medical School, and we're discussing themes from Ariel Gluckless's Sacred Pain. Armando, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Last week, I interviewed Ariel Gluckless about his book, and in it, he's concerned about self-infliction of pain, particularly in a religious context. Now, in your work, you don't really talk about self-infliction of pain, but you do a great deal on self-mutilation. And at least in most people's eyes and experience, these are going to be very closely related, because usually, if you mutilate yourself, you do something that would, in ordinary context at least, cause you a great deal of pain. And in fact, that's why I wanted you on the show, is I thought you could help illuminate this idea of self-mutilation, and we could then make some connections to Gluckless's discussion of sacred pain. In the introduction to your book, Bodies Under Siege, you spend a fair amount of time simply explaining that psychiatrists have always been reluctant to discuss, to examine, to study self-mutilation. And maybe it would be helpful to begin by asking you, why is that? Why have psychiatrists been so reluctant to discuss this phenomenon?
Well, I think it gives you a very helpless feeling to stand next to or be around someone who is deliberately harming themselves. And these individuals, aside from making you feel just terrible because they're doing this, I mean, the idea of being a physician is that you're supposed to heal people and make them better, but these people right in front of your eyes or come in and tell you they do it, that they hurt themselves, is a very terrible feeling. There's a lot of impulsivity associated with a lot of the cutting and burning behaviors and different sorts of self-harm behaviors. And so you may think that you have had the greatest therapeutic session in the world, and the patient leaves your office, and 2 hours later they're in the emergency room having harmed themselves. And so it's this terrible feeling that these patients cause psychiatrists to have that has played a role. Now, I think beyond that, and it's led to a lot of countertransference feelings, that is the whole literature of psychiatry until my book, in dealing with self-mutilators, is one of countertransference, saying it's just so terrible, we feel so bad dealing with these patients that we get negative feelings about them. And what I've tried to do is say, now, ladies and gentlemen, I realize it's tough for us, but think how what it must be like to the person who's actually doing it. It's even tougher for them. And I think beyond the countertransference, or something that lurks underneath it, something deeper, is that I truly believe that self-mutilators, with their self-violence, they touch upon something that is very unspoken. And I believe that it goes to the core of religion. That is, that while religion has, you know, aspects of love and joy and that sort of thing, but there also is a very violent core. In fact, Girard, who's one of the great scholars of religion, states that violence is the heart and the secret soul of the sacred. And he notes that religion shelters us from violence, just as violence seeks shelter in religion. And I believe that you know, at the core, if you look at the great myths of creation, if you look at the core of religion, there's always some sort of sacrifice. There's always some sort of violence. And I do believe that these patients, these individuals who mutilate themselves, they open up a certain door in our psyche, a door to the sacred. And it's not a very nice door. It leads us to a very bloody core. It's something that's not terribly nice to think about. And in fact, I believe that most of religious rituals are simply meant to take our mind off the sacrificial, the bloody, the sacred core of religion. So that's a kind of a long answer as to why psychiatrists have stayed away from it.
Okay, maybe it'd be helpful if you just would briefly describe what you mean by self-mutilation, and maybe just give a few examples.
Yeah, my definition of self-mutilation is pretty straightforward. It is the direct and deliberate alteration or destruction of body tissue without conscious suicidal intent. And so by this definition, when I first started looking at it and back in the 1980s, no one had ever really tried to classify all these mutilative behaviors. They just talked about self-mutilation as if it was one big thing. And I started looking around, and I said, well, okay, with my background in cultural psychiatry, let me see if I can make sense of it. And I said, okay, well, there are two major classifications. One is that there's culturally sanctioned self-mutilation, and this is the mutilation that's associated with deep-seated rituals and the mutilation that's involved with kind of meaningless fads and practices such as body piercing. Then you go over to the deviant type of self-mutilation, which is the product of mental illness. And here I classified it into four different types. The first type, which thank goodness is the rarest, is major self-mutilation. These are individuals who destroy significant body tissue and put themselves in danger of even death. And these are people, for example, who would castrate themselves or cut off, amputate a limb, or take out their eyes. Second type is what I call stereotypic self-mutilation. And this is the type of mutilation that you see especially in autistic and some mentally retarded patients and some rare syndromes, neurological syndromes. These are patients who bang their heads and bite off their fingertips, maybe bite off the tips of their tongues. And sometimes there's a rhythm associated with it, and it's done out in the open. It's done without any guile, and it seems to be the most biologically driven. The third type of self-mutilation is the type that psychiatrists don't see very often, but family practitioners do. This is the compulsive type, and it involves the pulling out of hair or the biting of your fingernails down to the quick or excoriating your skin. And then finally is the fourth type, which is the impulsive type, and this is the type that gets the most press and the type that drives most people crazy and probably the most prevalent, and these are the cutters and the burners. And the cutting and the burning, the skin cutting and the skin burning activity is part and parcel. It can be a symptom found in many different psychiatric disorders, but I believe also that people who cutting and burning gets so out of control that they know it becomes almost, it develops an autonomous course and becomes a syndrome in its own right. And we can talk about that later if you'd like.
Okay. One other clarificatory question. You used two different phrases in the beginning of the show. You talked about self-mutilation, and you also talked about self-harm. Do you see these as being the same?
Well, it's just words. I mean, the self-mutilation is a term that so many self-mutilators don't like, and they think it's too emotionally laden, so they like to refer to themselves as self-injurers, but sometimes the term self-harm is used. I think self-harm, to me, is a more broad term that can involve, you know, masochistic sorts of things or doing things to yourself psychologically that puts you in a bad situation, whereas self-mutilation is a little bit clearer, at least to me, but I can understand the sensitivity of people who are repetitive or chronic self-mutilators and who don't like to be called that, some of them. They prefer to be called self-injurers.
But part of the reason I was just asking is up front you acknowledge that self-mutilation is harmful to the individual who does it.
Well, I believe it's a morbid form of self-help. In other words, it's morbid in that, yeah, and it can end up in scars, it can end up in the loss or the alteration of body tissue, so it's morbid. But the reason people do it is to feel better, even if only temporarily.
Okay, so there's this interesting sense in which it's clearly harmful, namely it does damage to the bodily tissues, in some cases very severe damage. But that the rationale, to the extent that there is a rationale, is that the person thinks it's going to give them some kind of help or good feeling.
Gives them temporary relief.
Okay.
And it clearly does in most cases.
All right. Now, at the very beginning of your book, you talk about there being some parallels between the mutilation of others and self-mutilation. Could you say a little bit about what those parallels are and how they help illuminate self-mutilation?
Well, I don't mean self-mutilators are usually very timid, and they hurt only themselves. They do not hurt others. But I think when you look at the anthropological literature and you look at the cultural and even the cultural rituals as well as the practices, an individual will volunteer and let someone do something to them to alter or destroy their tissue. So they volunteer, they participate in this. And that's just often part of the ritual. And also, it's very difficult to tattoo yourself or to pierce yourself. Some people do, but obviously it's a lot easier to have someone who knows what they're doing do it. And the same way with rituals. They're very complicated, and they involve the entire community. And so it's not something you do in isolation, but you volunteer, and you let others do this to you. And so I think that the dynamics are the same in the sense that maybe you don't do it yourself, but by volunteering eagerly, let others do it to you, that it still sheds some light on the deviant form.
Now, I'm not a psychiatrist, but when I hear about the phenomenon or think about the phenomenon, I find myself assuming, rightly or wrongly, that someone who's interested in self-mutilation, again, particularly the more serious kinds, that they're preoccupied at least with their bodies, and perhaps in some ways we want to say they're preoccupied with themselves. Is that wrong, or is there some truth to that in your understanding of self-mutilation?
Well, self-mutilation for them is just a means to an end. It's a means to feel better. And oftentimes they've tried other things. They may have tried prayer. They may have tried to get therapy. They may have tried to do other things. And they often will stumble upon or come upon self-mutilation and discover that, wow, this really works. I feel good, you know, even though it's for a brief period of time. So, but the major type of self-mutilation, you know, the mutilation can itself resolve a conflict. I mean, people who for example, castrate themselves may have terrible conflicts about sin and the potential for sexual sin, or they may be fearful of indulging in homosexual acts. And so by castrating themselves, they've resolved an issue. They don't have to worry about committing sin anymore. So it's just a means to an end.
Okay. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. I mean, you use the language again of it being a means to an end. And I think your example of castration certainly goes toward answering this question. But I can imagine the response of most listeners, in some sense it's my response when I first hear about it, is, oh, come on. I mean, that seems odd to say it's a means to an end. If I'm trying to feel better, the last thing I would think about doing is burning myself or cutting myself or cutting off a limb. What is it about self-mutilators that makes them, leads them, encourages them to see self-mutilation as a means to an end?
Well, people who perform the major types of self-mutilation, fortunately quite rare, they are usually psychotic, that is, out of touch with reality, maybe hallucinating, or they're and under the influence of some sort of drug or alcohol, intoxicated at the time, it's fairly common, not fairly common, but it happens a lot in transsexuals who for example, a person who's born as a male but says, my goodness, God made a mistake, I really should be a female. And they may very deliberately go about the procedure of castrating themselves if they can't afford to get a physician to do it, or if the physician refuses to do it. So I don't know if that answers your question. I mean, they're out of touch with reality at the time when they do it. And a lot of times for example, most of the eyeballs that are taken out are in the United States, and I estimate they're probably around 300 or so per year. And the prototypical enucleator is a young man who happens to be in jail and may undergo a very deep depression, may eventually even become psychotic, and may have in the jail cell, in every jail cell in the United States, is usually a Bible. And if they happen to turn to the Gospels of St. Matthew or St. Mark, they come across this passage that says, you know, it's better to go into heaven with part of your body than to go into hell with all of it. And if your eye offends you, pluck it out. And if your hand offends you, cut it off. So if you're depressed, you're psychotic, you read this passage, everything clicks, and bam, out comes the eye. So they may be influenced. That's one example of how they could be influenced.
Okay, that's very, very helpful. I'm speaking today with Armando Favaza, professor of psychiatry at the University of Missouri. We're discussing Ariel Gluckless's book, Sacred Pain. In fact, what I'd like to do to maybe more clearly relate your interest and his is he's concerned about infliction of pain in the context of religion. And that's very similar, at least an overlapping category, it seems to me, with your category of culturally sanctioned self-mutilation. In particular, in fact, you've used this language a couple of times. You talk about the self-mutilation that happens in that context as being part of a ritual. And maybe it would help to just begin by saying, what counts as a ritual for you? What makes something a ritual? And then we can go on and look more specifically at how this works in the context of self-mutilation.
Well, when I'm looking at rituals, I'm looking at it. I'm looking at the culturally sanctioned types, and rituals are behaviors that persist within a society over a series of generations. They reflect their behaviors that reflect the traditional beliefs of a culture, and they often have a lot of symbolic meaning, they're most typically, the ones that are involved with self-mutilation are rituals that deal with religion, and rituals that deal with physical health, with bodily health, and rituals that have to do with social order. For example, when I talk about bodily health, among Australian Aborigines, whose behaviors go back to the earliest days of humankind, there is a very famous island, what they call the Island of Menstruating Men. And these are men who realize that women seem to be healthier than they are. And they try to understand why that's true. And the reason they come across is that, well, women seem to have monthly periods. So once a month, these men will get together, and they will deliberately sharp cactus spines in their nose, or they will gash open their penis and cause a lot of bleeding or hemorrhage to emulate the women, and also to get rid of what they believe is womb blood that is circulating in their system. And women get out every month through menstruation, but they have to get out artificially. So that's an example of how these mutilative rituals can go on every single month. And it's not only this island, but many other Aboriginal groups in Australia do that. It's a way to feel physically healthier. And if you look at shamanistic beliefs, shamans being healers who deal with the spirit world, in order to become a shaman, you have to undergo an initiatory illness. And in this illness, and it all occurs in a dream, but it seems very, very real, one has to undergo a stripping of one's body in which the organs are taken out and you're stripped down to a skeleton, and then you're reassembled again. So you're taken apart, you're ripped apart, and then you're put back together again, and the result makes you a healer, personally healthy and also a healer of others. The third example has to do with the social order. And here's where we get to coming-of-age rituals, which are often very, very terrifying, where there's a lot of, as a young boy or a young woman becomes an adult, they have to go through a lot of mutilation. Their skin may be made to look like an alligator's, and their teeth may be knocked out, or their penis may be sliced in half. They do this. They have to give up their autonomy in order to show the tribal elders that they're willing to give up their childish ways and willing to become adults, and they can take out whatever punishment is needed. During the pain and the terrifying moments of this initiation bonds them with the adults. But the end result is that there's a stability in the society. the person becomes an adult and allows the society to perpetuate itself.
Okay, and so each case there, within the culturally sanctioned submutilation, there is some goal that the person is trying to achieve. They think that the submutilation will help them achieve that goal.
Yes, and more than that, the culturally sanctioned involves not only the individual, but may involve the entire tribe or the entire group. One of the best examples is the Sundance of the Plains Indians, and the highlight of this great ceremony is where a large pole is erected with a long rope down, and the brave young men come out. The entire tribe beats on the drums so that the young men can go into a trance, and they put skewers of bone or wood through the muscles on their chest or back, attach it to the rope, and then they stare at the sun. And with everybody chanting and praying for them, they pull back and pull back and pull back until it just rips through their flesh. And they do it not only for their own spiritual well-being, but they're hoping to gain a vision that would help the entire tribe. So it's a very altruistic act. And it's a very ancient notion that even predates Plato, that if you would truly be free, you have to be free from the snares of the flesh. And what better way to be free from the flesh than to rip it open?
Would you see this? I mean, you talked earlier about violence as being somehow part of religion, fairly deeply a part of religion. Is this an important part of the role of violence, of self-mutilation in religion, then, is to strip away, if you will, a person's tie or connection to the body in the hope that they'll gain salvation, see the light, something of that sort?
Yeah, I think it's certainly within the Judeo-Christian tradition, and it's found in other traditions too. Mortification of the body is seen as a way to heaven. In fact, that up until fairly recent times, you couldn't become a saint in the Catholic Church unless you were a martyr or had zealously mortified your body. And you know, it's the notion, the great contribution, I think, of Judaism to the world was that through suffering comes redemption. And the phrase, by his wounds we are healed, in the Old Testament refers to Israel, the suffering servant. In the New Testament, the exact same phrase is applied to Jesus. And it's through his suffering that humankind becomes redeemed.
Could you say more about that? As a psychiatrist, I mean, what is it about pain that makes people see it as a road to redemption or salvation?
It's a cultural interpretation that somehow a pain rather than joy is is something intrinsic, something deep, and something that rests right at the core of spirituality. And that's what I was alluding to in the beginning. I think it opens that suffering opens up a cosmic space in the individual psyche. Something that we don't like to go there, you know. But certainly the duty of a Christian until fairly recently was to share in the sufferings of Christ, especially when there weren't any good medical treatments. And suffering almost became a Christian avocation. And it's only been in the 20th century where we've gotten good medical treatments now that people are saying, no, you really don't have to suffer. Jesus didn't really mean for people to suffer. He healed people. You don't have to go through that suffering. That's not necessary for salvation. But it's a very, very old, very ancient notion.
I mean, this is really pushing beyond the bounds of what you've written. But just taking two things that you said, one is that people see the suffering as, or the self-mutilation as a means to an end. And as you described it in the changed attitudes toward suffering, the necessity of suffering in order to get healing, that we've come to see that medicine allows us to get the end without those means.
Yes.
Can something like that go on for self-mutilators, that they can come to see that it's not necessary in order to get the end they want?
To a treatment and try to get them to realize that they don't have to injure their bodies to feel better. And you try to modify that with medication, with helping them with coping techniques, helping them change their cognitive distortions. You help that with, that's what therapy is about.
Okay. Now, we've just got about 4 minutes left. I want to ask some, just some final questions about self-mutilation. It seems to me that in some of the literature I've read, and unless I'm mistaken in your book, you say that women tend to be more often self-mutilators than men. Is that true? And if so, why?
Oh, I think it's probably true to some extent, although maybe it's 60-40. Percentage-wise, it's not a great variation. I think it's just that traditionally, men have tended to be somewhat more more stoic, and men have had more freedoms in society to express themselves, while women have not. Women have been under wraps, and that's one way of self-expression. They don't have all the means that men do. They're more bound to the home, or bound by certain restrictions of their society. Okay. And also, women are more likely to come forward to even seek help. And so, no one really knows the percentages, because as I said, a lot of men will not seek help. They'll make up stories. For example, the cutters and the burners, the men will make up stories about how they were injured at work, or how they got into a fight with somebody, or what have you. They'll make up all kinds of inventive stories. Well, women don't have that luxury. And for most illnesses, women are usually able to get the strength to come and seek help. And that covers for medical illnesses as well as strictly psychiatric ones.
Okay, so at least one possible explanation is that if you are or feel relatively powerless, mm-hmm. one of the things that self-mutilation does is it gives you a certain amount of power, at least over yourself.
Yeah, I think that is true for some cases. I know some people who have very rapidly fluctuating emotions, emotional states. They just can't get there. They're like in a roller coaster. They can't control themselves. And I had one patient I talk about in the book who, when that would happen and they needed to establish control of themselves, would just take a hammer and just smash his foot. I mean, he was broken all the bones in his feet. But the intensity of striking the foot and saying, I'm in control, and the sudden jolt to the body would stop things from reeling around him, and for a short period of time at least, everything, he said, I'm in control. I inflict this pain on myself, and I'm the one who does it. I'm the one who can stop it, and therefore I'm in control.
Okay. Do you have any final thoughts in the last 30 seconds or so? Any last thing you'd like the listener to think about or understand?
Well, just that self-mutilation is a morbid act of self-help. People who are self-mutilators, they're humans just like everyone else. Their acts may seem horrific, they may seem senseless, but there is some sense behind it if you take the time to look at it.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking today with Armando Favazzo, professor of psychiatry at the University of Missouri Medical School. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.